In 1962, Dr. William Lee founded the Sacramento Observer. 11 years later, the paper won the first of what would be 6 national awards for being a leading African-American newspaper. On Insight, Dr. Lee's son Larry remembers his father, who died September 22nd. Our newsroom is tracking the PG&E-initiated power outages and the incoming north wind. You can find ongoing coverage at capradio.org. In our second half hour, a new comedy album by Keith Lowell Jensen. You can hear it today on Sirius XM. Maybe you were in the audience for the live event. We'll listen back to a conversation Randall White had with Keith just before the recording. And later in the hour, jazz composer and bandleader Jacob Manrix. He previews his new Jacob Manrix Orchestra, and we'll hear the story behind his name. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's coming up today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Almost 1 million customers in California are without power, as you've been hearing all morning. That's nearly 750,000 from PG&E in the northern area, 200,000 from Southern California Edison. PG&E says it might expand the outage area at noon, and all of this because of the incoming north winds and the high wildfire danger. My colleague Ben Adler spoke with the California Office of Emergency Services this morning, and the report is that up to 2 million people across the state will be impacted by, quote, the public safety power shutoff. So again, we suggest that you stay with Cap Radio, and you can find maps of the outage areas and more information that's up to date at capradio.org. Now to a story that also, like the power outage story, is echoing across the country, and that is the passing of Dr. William Lee, the founder and publisher of the Sacramento Observer. Dr. Lee died on September 22nd. He was 83 years old. His son, Larry Lee, has joined me in the studio to talk about his father. Hi, Larry. Glad to have you back.
Good morning, Beth. Thank you for having me.
And of course, we extend our condolences on your loss.
Absolutely.
This
Thank
has been
you.
Such a big community event. I'd like to read the first two sentences from The Observer, from the website. And this is the obituary for your father. He was tireless in the fight for access and respect for Black journalists, and relentless in championing for Blacks to have a seat at the proverbial table. Sacramento Observer Publisher Emeritus Dr. William H. Lee went to his glory, having passed away on Sunday, September 22nd. There's so much in those few sentences about the chorus that is around the life and legacy of your dad.
Sure.
How's it been to hear all that, to continually hear all that since September 22nd?
Well, again, thank you for having me. It's been absolutely overwhelming and beautiful, to say the least. You know, my parents, and I will keep them together, my mom and dad, they did work tirelessly for this community in a lot of different ways, in a lot of ways, sometimes seen, sometimes unseen. But I think... In closing this chapter of their legacy and my dad's pass with my dad's passing, it's been wonderful to kind of reflect on his impact, not only through the pages of the paper. I said also, you know, his impact expanded way past the distribution of the paper, way past the walls of the office. It was more than just, he was more than just a publisher. In many ways, he was, you know, kind of the conscience of the community. And I've kind of heard that from other people. You know, Mayor Steinberg was at the memorial the other day, and he talked about getting a call from Bill Lee, and he said, you know, you'd get that call and immediately thought of, what did he do wrong? He's like, I do not want to disappoint Bill Lee. And that's beautiful to hear.
You were the youngest of 3 sons.
Correct.
You must have had some of that in you, too. I don't want to disappoint mom or dad.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that was, you know, I was the youngest. My parents were almost 40 years old when they had me. My oldest brother was 17 years older than I am. And he passed away about 25 years ago or so. And so there was definitely that impact. By the time I was here, the joke is he was always he was already Dr. Lee at that point for me. So there was never, even though I always called him Dad at home and everything, but in public and everything, it was always, you know, kind of that reverence for him and my mom, of course, as well, too. But definitely for him, having been such a tremendous leader, he kind of attributed my birth. I was born in 73. You mentioned the year that we won, kind of the first year when we became the nation's best black newspaper. And he said that was my gift to the paper, was that we got named the nation's best black newspaper. And ever since then, we've been on a great run.
Mm-hmm. When Ronald Reagan was governor of California, mm-hmm. he would visit Oak Park and visit your family. I guess the Reagan kids and all of you went to the same elementary school?
With my middle brother, yeah.
So this wasn't unusual for the governor to call Bill Lee and ask his advice on issues. And the governor understood that your family knew the pulse of the African American community. So that's the atmosphere that you grew up in.
Yeah.
And how did that play for your parents with you kids in teaching what the expectation was going to be of your entire family, including you, mm-hmm. in the community?
I think the thing that was really driven home to us was that you could expect, if you did really good work and it came from a good place, you could expect great things. My parents never had anything but excellence in their work. And so while it sounds funny to say, yes, okay, governor, you know, being among governors or heads of states and those kinds of things were somewhat commonplace. I mean, it wasn't every day, but it was somewhat commonplace. You know, my dad in the same breath would very much say, hey, you know, I'm a kid who came from Del Paso Heights and went to Grant High School. My mom, you know, her family was in Oak Park. And so it was like they were very much rooted into the community. And so it wasn't necessarily about, you know, lifting the Lees up, but it was kind of how do we push the agenda for the African-American community in Sacramento from these areas and these communities that we are from? And how do we move it in a way that is really benefiting not just our community, but the Sacramento community at great lengths. And my dad was very insightful in really trying to make sure that when he got into a room, into a room where he was, at that time, the only African-American in the room, and said, and let's say he had someone like Governor Reagan at the table with him, it was not about Bill Lee moving forward. It was about, Governor, we need more black judges. We need more black appointees. We need more black staffers in the Capitol. And so they would go, when they would meet with them, it was more of, I've got three people that I'm going to make sure that when we leave here, the governor knows to call them to get them into positions. Three African Americans who did not have an opportunity before. Or my mom would do the same thing with particularly for female staffers at the state capitol. They were selfless and just very much really about really just trying to help other people. And I think that's the message. That was something I lived with, but that's also the message I hear from others, particularly during this season of his passing.
Larry, are you okay if we play a clip of your dad's voice?
I think I'll be all right.
Yeah, right.
I hear it all the time in my head, so.
You too.
So I'm probably hearing it out loud might be fine.
Let me pick up on that for a moment.
Sure.
Because losing a parent is one of the most significant events in a person's life.
Sure.
And immediately after it happens, your mind does stick on certain stories or certain tapes. Mm-hmm. What are you hearing him say? What is your experience with him right now?
It's varied. It's a lot of different things. All right, Beth, you're messing with me here, but no, it's okay. But, I spent a lot of time around my parents.
Yeah.
My mom was bedridden for about 10 years, before her passing. And, excuse me, my dad, you know, the last couple of years were pretty tough for him.
Yeah.
So I spent a lot of time with him. I'm sorry. But I'm just very grateful. I think more than anything, I'm very grateful because I don't regret a minute. I don't have a second where I'm not thankful for the wisdom that they shared with me. They poured a lot into me. Yeah.
Let's listen then. And I am going to let our production team know that I'd like to go to the section where your dad talked about changing the rules. And this is kind of a long piece from the KVIE Studio Sacramento show in 2013. Your family was marking the 50th anniversary of the publication of the paper, and you and your dad were talking with the host, Scott Syfax. And Scott had asked your dad about the culture of the early 60s when the paper was new. So let's listen to about 2 minutes here of Dr. William Lee.
We really had very few African-Americans in key positions, in any positions and so forth. There were no black judges, as an example, no blacks on television, no blacks, if you will, on our city council or in our board of supervisors, very few in the Capitol. In fact, we were looking at it the other day, and we felt in, when we formed the Observer in 62, that there actually was only 3 African-American staffers working in the state capitol.
You're kidding.
Can you imagine that?
Wow. And,
you know, so from that very first beginning, we were able to serve really kind of as a catalyst for many of these job opportunities, for many of the announcements that were occurring, for many of actually the appointments that were being made. And we were consulted frequently by those who are in positions to make some of those appointments.
Incidentally, in being a catalyst and breaking down doors, you didn't just do that in the African-American community. There's a story that I recently heard about how publications like Time and Newsweek couldn't participate in the coverage of the Capitol, and the Observer broke down the door that allowed them to be able to be a part of the Bureau. Tell us that story.
We could not be credentialed, if you will, because we were not we met the Rules Committee requirement at that time, is that you had to be a daily newspaper, as an example, in order to have a credential. So you couldn't get up and cover. So magazines like Time Magazine, who was not obviously a daily publication, nor were the Observer, could not be credentialed. So we, in a sense, we challenged that credentialing rule and was able to change the Rules Committee requirements at the time. And we were able then to open up the doors for many of the publications who were weeklies and other publications as well.
So he was pretty much all business. Or he was a lot of business. I know at home his big warm personality was there, but but he really took on the mantle of change. What's interesting to me is that in that same conversation he talked about the founding of this newspaper being at the kitchen table.
Yeah.
And it was he and your mom and Gino Gladden.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. John Cole, who Gino Gladden passed away shortly after they started the paper, but John Cole at 101 years old is still around and looking sharp and dapper as always.
Wow.
He was at the funeral the other day and it was, he stood up and everyone gave him a great big applause as well too. Yeah, so that was great.
I think your mom ironically passed in the year of the 50th anniversary
of the paper. Yeah.
So your dad was talking about the impact of the paper, and we have a short little clip about that. So here again is the late Dr. Bill Lee.
We had no idea. The key there is that we wanted to serve, though, Scott. That was our main intent.
Mm-hmm.
There was very little information. We feel now there was no marketplace of where a person could go and find out events in the African-American community. And so our intent was really to provide that kind of information from events that were occurring, information about groups that might be forming, some of the deaths and births, if you will, of our community and that type of thing.
I really respect that he was talking about public service in the beginning.
Sure.
And that the paper then, would you say something about the role that it started to have and the role that it still has now 56 years later?
Yeah, I think it's evolved and changed. The one thing that I definitely would say is that, and I'll say this in the most journalistic way I can say it, there really will never be another Bill Lee. And by that, I mean the timing of the civil rights era, the starting of the paper, the growth of Sacramento, his and my mom's connection as a unit, their dedication to service in the community. Like, that's a special kind of cocktail mix that just probably will never happen again. And the era of newspapers being what they were as well, too, during that era as well. So all of that is a spectacular mix that I think really helped really put his and their legacy into context. But moving forward and building on the foundation that we've had is tremendous. I think we have been able over the years, and we've been very fortunate, and my dad would say this too, very fortunate to be in Sacramento. There's other places where you could have other larger Black populations and been more successful as a newspaper publisher when you're trying to, you know, build a business. But he was happy to grow with Sacramento. For sure. And then when you look at the mix of his and my mom's legacy, and then the fact that I came back, and it's hard to believe, but I've literally have been back for 22 years working with them, and the fact that, you know, my, and for lack of a better word, my patience and understanding of kind of knowing when and where that place and that my time will come. And it doesn't, I don't have to rush them out or anything like that. And being patient with that, I think we're very fortunate as a business and as a newspaper and as a news media outlet that our roots are really connected to this community. So moving forward, you know, we're in the midst of remodeling a new facility where we relocated to the Del Paso Boulevard in North Sac, building what we feel is going to be a 21st century newsroom that will prepare us for another generation. Understanding that newspaper and our print product is still extremely valuable, but also knowing that, you know, as the technology changes, we have to change with it. And that's something that if my dad was by himself, may not have been able to embrace and move forward with as our newspaper moves forward. So I feel like our voice and our role is still going to be valuable. And I have a really, what I feel is a big vision for our paper as well, too. It might be a little bit different than, you know, my dad would have done at this age, but I also am dealing with a different sort of, different sort of environment for news and information. So I'm excited about where we're headed, for sure. And I couldn't have any of it set up without their work.
You're listening to Larry Lee. He assumed the active leadership of the Sacramento Observer in 2015. We are talking about, and you have been hearing the voice of the late Dr. William Lee, co-founder and a few years later publisher of the Observer, which is now 56 years old. Dr. Lee died on September 22nd. He was a Pulitzer Prize judge in 1987. Yeah. What a remarkable credential to have in life experiences. What else was really important to him that he was able to do?
Well, there's too many. I don't, how long of a show do you have? No, there were really so many. I think two of the ones that stand out. One was being the chair of the Martin Luther King Holiday Commission for the state of California, being selected by a Republican governor and George Duke Majan to chair the effort to get California to have a Martin Luther King holiday before there was even a national holiday. For my dad, was a tremendous honor. He had a great regard and respect for Dr. King. And was very thankful to have led that effort. And then in his later years, Getting a school named after him. Mm-hmm. There's William Lee College Prep, which is a public charter school run by the Fortune School of Education. And he was the first African-American or first person of that system to be named after living African-American leaders, of which there's several here in the region. And the actual physical building is actually the school where my mom went to elementary school.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that was really a great testament. He was so proud of that school, of the Fortune family leadership with that, and the kids that that go there as well, too.
I heard him say education is most important in so many interviews, so many conversations. He just really put that first. But I want to go back to that KVIE episode of Studio Sacramento. Scott Syphax asked him what he was looking forward to, what he thought about life and what was coming and our role in it. So here's another short clip of the late Dr. William Lee.
I really feel that sometimes we're missing in the courage to move forward on many of the challenges. When we face a barrier, we run away from it instead of being challenged by it. And really, I think those who don't understand really the community, we invite those to reach out to those sectors they don't understand. I think those limitations really will only hurt them in the long run, those who don't understand the diversity that's happening in our community. It's a warm community. As I said, it's a rainbow of different colors in our community, and it's an outstanding community, and it's been very helpful to us.
He was almost prophetic, wasn't he, in 2013, in looking at what would be important, especially in the recent years?
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely.
Did he give you advice?
Oh, are you kidding me?
Where do you want to pinpoint it? To running the paper, in life, in being a good person? What comes to mind when I ask you that?
Well, in the business side of things, gosh, I got so many. I'm actually compiling a little list of what I quote unquote Dr. Lee statements. He would say stuff like, it's better to have it and not need it than to need it and not have it. Mm-hmm. And stuff like that. So on the business sides of things, he gave me really probably too many to name.
You need to publish that list.
Oh, I know. That's well, actually, we are doing a special edition on his commemorating his life. We'll publish it later this month. And it's going to be filled with, lots of different things. That is a part of that is going to be one of the things that we'll publish in that as well, too, because I started to put together a list of about 10 or 12 of them that were like, oh, gosh, I heard the dad say this 1,000 times. I think, he was a very spiritual man. He was the son of a Baptist preacher here in Sacramento. And as I said at the funeral the other day, that legacy that my dad had really was built on the legacy that my grandparents had and really kind of feeding into the community of Del Paso Heights. And so I think that, as I move forward, obviously keeping scripture close and near to me is important. He always would say, none of this stuff is permanent. It's all, because of the good Lord. He's given things to us in order to be good stewards. I think that's probably one of the biggest words that he always said, be a good steward for whatever you get.
Thank you so much for your willingness to talk about your dad at this point in time, in the newness of this time, and for sharing some of truly the beauty of his life with us.
Yeah. Thank you again for having me so much. I really appreciate it.
That is Larry Lee, the publisher now of the Sacramento Observer. His parents, Dr. William and Catherine Lee, co-founded the paper in 1962. Dr. Lee died in September at the age of 83. You can find more, including links to the paper and a link to the KVIE episode with them at capradio.org/insight. I'll add a PS to this, that tomorrow Cap Radio launches a new in-depth podcast titled Making Meadowview, and you'll hear hear many voices and many stories in the history of Sacramento neighborhoods as well. You'll hear more about that in tomorrow's show. One more reminder, there is ongoing coverage of the power outages, the wind, and the wildfire potential. It's all on our website as well. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. You can find ongoing coverage of the power outages and the weather conditions at capradio.org. Keith Lowell Jensen's new comedy album is about to be released. It's titled Unclean. SiriusXM's Raw Dog Comedy, in fact, is going to air the album at 11 o'clock this morning, Pacific Standard Time, then again at 7 p.m. tonight. The album hits streaming services everywhere on October 11th. Maybe you were in the live audience, but let's go back to July. Here's a conversation with Randall White just before the recording.
Unclean, yeah, because I just recorded a clean album for 800 Pound Gorilla Records, and it made me just a ton of money. So naturally, you know, I have to shoot myself in the foot and now go do a dirty one.
So unclean refers to the language.
Yeah, but I also like that it has this sort of religious connotation. you know, unclean has been used to describe, well, I don't know, people like me. What's funny, though, is I don't consider myself a particularly dirty comic, but after doing a clean album and it getting a lot of play on satellite radio, I started having people come to my shows assuming I was a clean comedian. And so I've had to give a few refunds over the last year.
Interesting.
And so I thought, well, let's make sure this one's clearly labeled so they don't buy it on accident and hurt their delicate ears. But it's not particularly dirty, but it's just not, you know, it's unclean.
So deciding content, like, what is your process for organizing material for an album?
This one's interesting because it's just such a mishmash, which I think is fun. It jumps all over the place.
So there's no big picture.
Right. And there's always been a big picture in the past, some sort. You know, there's a period where I was talking a lot about becoming a father for the first time, and then I did the album that was all about all the jobs I had. As you mentioned, I have a set that I'm working on that'll probably be my next big special about all the times I've been arrested. So this one's just like everything that couldn't go on the clean album and that wasn't about a job I had, you know, because you're still writing all the time. And so you just tucking them away. And then my tuck it away file was getting pretty big. I was like, I should record. So
do you have an editor?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do. I make most of the decisions as far as the editing. But 800 Pound Gorilla Records will work with me. They're great because they never tell me I have to do anything. They always go, well, we have a market for this if you want to do it. And I'm like, you know, they're saying to me, if you like making money, here's a thing you can do. But whatever you want. You
know? How did you hook up with them?
Let's see. J.R. de Guzman, actually, another local comedian who's fantastic. He had an album and his seemed to be doing better than mine, even though I thought that mine was better than his. Sorry, JR. So, no, JR is great. But I went to him and I said, hey, how are they treating you? And he said, oh, I love them. And I wasn't real happy with my label at the time. So I reached out to them and they already knew me and they were real quick to say, yeah, let's do it. Actually, they really surprised me because they were like, well, when do you want to record? I was like, what do you mean? When do I, you know? Next month, they were like, sure.
Let's do it.
Yeah, so we did. We recorded the KLJ Greatest Bits, and that's just done amazing things for me. So,
if you hit a spot where the audience isn't responding, can you just use that as a little
seasoning?
Then I
just say, put a bleep in there so it sounds like I cursed.
Right.
No one will ever know that I didn't.
Last year, you released a lot of material, two albums and a book. Are you trying to top yourself this year?
Yeah. So another comedian was teasing me last Sunday. at the Punch saying, oh, so when you're up recording your album, are you going to announce the date for your next album recording? As I mentioned, I was with a record label that I was frustrated with, and they were taking a really long time to release my stuff. So that's why I'm churning out so much stuff so quickly. Mm. It's going to slow down after this one. It's just that when they're taking 2 years to release an album, I have material piling up. I like to release something every year. Yeah. So now, you know, I released 2 recordings and a book last year, and I'm going to release 2 albums this year. And then I'm going to slow down to a normal speed.
Let's talk about the book a little bit, Punching Nazis and Other Good Ideas. What inspired that project, and have you punched any Nazis recently?
No, I've never punched a Nazi, and I confess that right from the beginning in the book. It's the book is written from a fan's perspective. I'm a huge fan of Nazi punching, but I've not partaken yet. I haven't found my opportunity, but I hope that I will. I hope that someday I will find my Nazi to punch and be in the right place to do it. So on Trump's inauguration day, Richard Spencer got punched in the face on live TV, and it went viral. And right away, in liberal circles, we all started arguing about the morality and ethics of punching Nazis. And I was like, yes, punch them all. and I felt that we are justified in doing so after, you know, millions and millions of people died the last time Nazis grabbed any kind of power. So a friend of mine, Carrie Poppy, who hosts a very popular podcast called Oh No, Ross and Carrie, was offered a book deal. And she did the delightful thing of saying, you know, I don't really have a book for you, but you should have Keith Olgensen write a book. And they were like, who? And she said, Keith Olgensen, he could write about punching Nazis. So I was so amazed to get an email saying, hi, we're from Skyhorse Publishing. Would you like to write a book about publishing Nazis? And I was like, punching, a whole book? You know? So I thought about it and went back and forth with them a little bit and then was like, yeah, I can do it. And it's funny because I've written books before and I'll send them to one publisher and get one rejection letter and then I can't take it and I stop. Like with comedy, you get that immediate response. And right. If you bomb, you go out the next night and kill because you need it, you know. To spend months and months working on something and then get a rejection letter, I'm like, nah, I'll stick with the stage. This is nonsense. So it was so great to have them come to me and be like, here's an advance. Write your little heart out. And even then, when I was done with it and sent it to them, it was so nerve-wracking because I was just sure they were going to reject it. Like, be like, no, this isn't what we wanted.
You were afraid they were going to start with the compliment. This is really great, but...
Right.
And then start, you know, telling you how bad it is.
And instead, the editor said, do you know Aaron Cometbus? And I said, he's one of my absolute favorite writers. And she said, cool, because I'm a big fan of his, and your voice reminds me of his. Not in a bad way, but it's reminiscent in a good way of his. And I was floored, because not many people know Aaron Cometbus, not as many as should. And I felt like, oh, I have an editor who actually gets what I'm trying to do. All the things where I was afraid they would be like, oh, this part's too, I don't know, doesn't go anywhere or meanders. Well, if you like Aaron Cometbus, then you like that and you get that, you know. Another editor might have been like, nah, that needs to have more of a point, you know. So it was cool. It was a really good experience. And really, we'll probably do a soft cover version of the book next year. We've got like, I think, 1,000 copies left to sell, and then they'll let me record possibly an audiobook of it and a soft cover. So if you're out there, go buy it. And the funny story is it has an unfortunate Roseanne Barr quote on the cover.
Oh, it does.
And the next pressing will not. So this will be a collector's item. Go get the one with the Roseanne Barr quote.
We're speaking with comedian Keith Lowell Jensen, and he's recording a new album for 800 Pound Gorilla Records this weekend. It's called Unclean. So you mentioned that you do have an idea for a future book.
Oh, I mean, I've written a book version of Not For Rehire.
Oh, I see. Okay, yes.
So I've written books before, and yeah, I'm sure I will write books again. But no, I actually have 2 kids' books, one of which is going to be published by Clash Books, called Tiger Torn, about a little girl helping her tiger get a job, very much inspired by my daughter. And then I have another one called Peanut Butter the Dragon, and we'll see if that can get, maybe we'll publish that as well. So, but then, yeah, I might write a grown-up book again.
What drives you? Like, what drives you to keep doing this?
Oh, I love the Woody Allen quote, I have to say he's a dirtbag every time I say his name now, right? That's the disclaimer. But I love the quote where they asked him if he was trying to achieve immortality through his work. And he said, no, I'm trying to achieve immortality through not dying. But no, I don't know what drives me. I guess it's that normal urge of just wanting to leave something of yourself.
When did you know you were funny?
Oh, I resisted it for a long time. The first time I ever got called a class clown, I took it as a huge insult. only later did I embrace it. So,
class clown is now paying the bills.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know when I knew I was funny. But I remember a few times at parties where I sort of held court being funny. And then there's this weird mix of like being proud of yourself and also some self-loathing because you're like, oh, I made myself the center of attention. So the stage is so great because it's like,
you're supposed to be doing that.
It's said the lights are aimed at you. The microphone's pointed at you. It's set up for that. You're raised up a little bit. And now I have so much more fun at parties because now at parties I don't want to be the center of attention at all. I'm like, I'm just here as an observer.
If your child shows an inclination to go in that same direction as you, what will be your response?
She's already there. Yeah, we're waiting to go on stage together. She's writing jokes. She's doing. What's funny is that the first comedy I introduced her to was Mitch Hedberg. So she thinks every joke has to be said in Mitch Hedberg's rhythm. She's like, Daddy, I wrote a joke. And then the joke starts, I like oranges. She just Mitch Hedberg's every joke. But she's already writing jokes and good jokes. So, yeah. I would tell you one. But when I've done that before, she gets mad at me because she's like, Dad, you didn't do it right. So I'm like, all right, baby.
It's all in the delivery, Dad. Yeah, Come on.
So I blow her jokes. But yeah, we'll get on stage together one of these days.
That was Keith Lowell Jensen talking with Randall White back in July. The new comedy album is played today on Sirius XM. It officially goes out on services everywhere October 11th. Just for a preview, let's listen to a clip from The Real Deal.
When you've been in a relationship for a long time, people ask you advice, you know? How do you do it? Like, be poor. Be very, very poor. We have fought. We've had our moments. We could not afford to separate. We have one car. We have a lease. If we wanted to break up, we'd have to start saving up. So we have weathered the storm instead. If it got bad enough and we were like, that's it, we're breaking up, it'd be like, all right, I'm putting this jar on the table and we're throwing all our extra money in there till there's enough for us to get a divorce. And a week in, we'd be like, there's enough to go out to sushi. We should just make up. And that's how you do it. That's why we're together. We're together because we're very bad financial planners and we really like sushi. It works.
And so that was from the album Unclean. Sirius XM's Raw Dog Comedy will air it, the full album, at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. That's today. You can find it everywhere on October 11th. And Keith teaches his stand-up comedy 101 class at Punchline Sacramento starting on October 15th. All that information is on our website at capradio.org/insight. Congratulations to Keith. And you're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. This is Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Jacob Manrix is a jazz musician, a composer. He performs, he's led groups, and now he has assembled a pretty remarkable brand new Jacob Manrix Orchestra, and he's writing a brand new show. So I'm about to introduce a person with a very busy, productive life.
Hi, Beth. Thanks for having me on.
Nice to have you here.
Oh, my pleasure.
I heard there was a little exchange out in the green room about your name.
Oh, yeah. It's bizarre. I don't know what my parents were thinking. They must have, I don't know what they were drinking that night or who knows.
Is there another Jacob in the world?
I don't think so. Yeah. But it's a strange one. So it's J-A-C-A-M. And the J-A comes from my mother's name, Jeanette. And the C-A-M comes from my father's name, Camilio. So it's Jacob.
Can you imagine them having that conversation? Well, let's put part of your name and my name together.
That's why I said I just have no idea what they were drinking that night. It must have been good.
And there's a mix in your background of cultures, yeah, countries, and musical
for
styles.
Sure.
Will you map it out a little bit?
For sure. So my parents were both immigrants to Australia. My mum's British and my father's from Sri Lanka. And though he was studying in the States, he went to Peabody Conservatory on the East Coast in Baltimore.
Okay.
And they both got gigs in a state orchestra in Brisbane, in my hometown. You know, and this is 70s, I guess, late 60s. So, you know, the orchestras were popping up all over the world. It was a big thing, mm-hmm, unlike today where we're facing a lot of difficulty with arts funding and funding for,
right,
for state, or you see state orchestras being slashed. So they were lucky and they met in the orchestra and I guess fell in love and I'm the result of that.
And now you're taking on an orchestra. We've talked with you before. It's been either solo projects or small group projects. Let's start with just some sound from rehearsal. Thank you very much for recording some of this.
Sure.
We'll listen to a little bit of it. This is Cry, part one, and then we'll talk more.
Okay, sure.
That sounds like difficult music, and it isn't representative of the fact that you have 19 pieces. You have saxophones, trumpets, trombones, and then we were hearing the rhythm section.
Right, right. Yeah, so the rhythm section wasn't really in a traditional way. They weren't playing in a traditional way right there. This piece, Cry, which is based on a song I wrote and recorded in 2011 on my album Cloud Nine, also recorded on another album. It was just a song that I wrote. It was just a simple melody, and the theme is like ba-dee-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's the beginning of the melody.
Mm.
So
that's what we heard the trumpet play.
That's what we just heard. Yeah, the trombones and the trumpet.
Mm-hmm.
They do that there. But there's also at the very end of the song. It's quite a long song. It's not your traditional jazz 32 bar song. I think it's like 50 bars or something. Like, I can't remember. At the end of the song, there's this bass lick that goes da-da-da-da, like that. And so it's a grouping of five. So what we were hearing then was that, but not orchestrated for the bass, but orchestrated for the piano and the guitar and I think the vibraphone.
This is a hard song for everybody to learn.
It's difficult. So it's in 5-4, but there's all sorts of polyrhythms happening. So there's 2/5, 3/5, 4/5 happens. So there's all this complexity that's happening in the music. It's a very orchestral style of jazz arrangement. It's less traditional, this particular piece.
We have a clip from the middle of the song, and I think this is a section that will sound a little more straightforward in its arrangement.
Yeah.
So again, this is Cry by Jacob Manrix and performed at rehearsal by the Jacob Manrix Orchestra. We'll be right back. it's a lot to take on. And as I said, you already have a very busy life. Maybe with the story about your parents, that was part of the impetus to getting back around to an orchestra?
Definitely. The concept of a large ensemble orchestra or just many people collaborating in the field of the arts, I think, is of the utmost importance, especially in the times that we're living in now, that there's focus on trying to make something beautiful together. Mm. Something that, you know, a language. Music is a language, and trying to make a language that can talk to people, that can let people escape from, you know, whatever troubles they have, and just create something beautiful to share with the world.
I'm looking at the list of musicians you've pulled together. Mm. Levi Sailua, Mike McMullen, you have Brandon Owl, Ben Koff, and how have you been able to find time with these people who are already busy, most of them in multiple bands and projects themselves?
Yeah, I guess I'm just super lucky because these guys, all of the guys in the band are people that I have, I love their playing and their musicianship. They're all wonderful musicians, many of whom have their own great projects, and I encourage you to check those out.
I think they wanted to play with you.
I hope so. Yeah, that's the idea, because I wanted to play with them. And, you know, in my 5 years of being in Sacramento, I've always wanted to try to get these musicians together in the same room and have some musical dialogue between us.
So everyone will be there at the debut of the Vanguard Jazz Series,
oh, yeah.
Correct?
Yeah. It's not the debut of the Vanguard Jazz Series. That's been going now for a couple years. The Vanguard Jazz Series, I started with Joe Gilman and myself.
Sure, we've talked about that in past years,
but it's the debut of the Jacob Manrix
Orchestra.
Yeah.
And the date is October 13th. It is at 7 p.m. location.
At the Clara Auditorium downtown, Midtown. Yeah, it's on N and 24th, I believe.
So the doors will open at 6:30 and then at 7. How are you balancing life? How are you balancing a full life?
I'm doing okay. I've got an amazing wife and, you know, it really helps. And I've got an amazing group of friends too, you know, whether it's, hey, can you bring Lilia home from soccer, or, you know, can you pick Sydney up? And we're just very lucky. We've made some amazing friends here, and it feels like we've got our family here now.
Your specialty is saxophone, although maybe composing is becoming more the specialty. But let's listen to a clip called Nucleus, just a little bit of it, because it does start with a sax solo. Jacob Manrix, where do you go when you're playing like that and you can just lose yourself a bit in it?
I go to my ears, try to go to my ears. And again, it's just all about communicating and trying to be in the moment. You're improvising, but you have developed, I've developed my language, which is, you know, a cumulative of all the music that I've listened to my whole life, classical music, jazz, taking from the greats, and developing my own language, and then just trying to, it's basically just like trying to speak, just like we're doing right now. You know, we're in this moment, we're having this moment together where we're talking to one another and communicating, and that's basically what I'm trying to do with the musicians and the audience. It makes such a difference when there's an audience there that are into the music.
You just gave me a great idea. Next time you come, bring the saxophone.
I will.
And I'll talk.
Okay.
But you play. You answer me with the sax, well, okay?
Yeah, that's a great idea.
We'll do that because I know that even if people don't hear the words, they'll know how the conversation is going.
Well, firstly, there's rhythm in everything, and especially in speech, and there's also pitch. And we know that from recordings where great composers have transcribed speech and turned that into music.
So I know you'll be awesome, so I'll try to be really good that day, too.
Okay. I'm sure you will. You'll be very inspiring.
Jacob, it's always a treat to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me, Beth.
This is exciting, the debut of the Jacob Manrix Orchestra, October 13th, 7 o'clock at the Clara Auditorium in Midtown Sacramento. Good luck with this project.
Thank you so much. I'm super excited about it.
I'll see you next time with the sax.
Okay.
And that's Insight for today. By the way, stay at capradio.org for updates throughout the day about power outages, the weather, and the wildfire potential. Thanks for joining us today.